From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Madeline Brand.
And we're starting today with Climate Connections. This is our year-long series on how climate changes people and how people change climate. We're continuing, Madeline, with your trip to Japan, where we're learning that even in this country, they struggle with meeting their limits for CO2 emissions. And this is where they wrote the Kyoto Protocol, right?
That's right. Yeah. Kyoto, Japan. So we thought it might be a good idea to go to Japan and see how they live. Maybe they could teach us how to live more greenly. Because compared to the Japanese, we Americans per capita, we generate twice as much CO2, 45,000 pounds a year.
For every single one of us?
Each. Yes, each. And the Japanese, they just recycle more, they ride bikes, and in general live small. Take this guy.
Well, my name is Motoyuki Shibata. People call me Moto.
Moto teaches American literature at the University of Tokyo. He and his wife Hitomi are greener than most Japanese. They don't own a car. They have a solar panel on the roof. They collect rainwater in an old whiskey barrel to water the plants. Oh, and they don't use dish soap. They just scrape their dishes and rinse them.
It works. You never need soap.
Moto has built a wooden Japanese soaking tub. You know, the kind you get into only after you've scrubbed yourself thoroughly.
This is the biggest luxury we had when we built this house.
It was the bathtub.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, yes.
Still, his wife Hitomi recycles his bathwater to wash the clothes. She takes a big tube and runs it from the tub into the small washer.
Plug it in. Yeah, yeah. Oh.
And just like that, the water flows from the tub into the machine. Okay, that's a little extreme even by Japanese standards, but Moto is like most Japanese in that he doesn't own a clothes dryer. Look outside and you see laundry drying on most balconies.
You get to see lots of clothes hanging in the daytime here.
It's not something you'd see in the United States.
Right. I don't think so many people own dryer here, partly because of the space. Space is very valuable.
When I went there this summer, I could see this attention to space everywhere. A Japanese-American friend of mine who lives in Tokyo told me he is rarely mistaken for a native, if only because of the way he walks. He walks like an American, arms swinging with a loose gait. Japanese people keep their arms in, their steps short and clipped. They have adapted to living in close quarters for centuries. They've developed rituals that celebrate the minimal, such as the 600-year-old tea ceremony.
You purify yourself before you enter the tea ceremony room.
Dressed in a creamy white summer kimono, Masako Konishi agrees to show me the tea ceremony at her home just outside Tokyo.
The formal one does have it, a small entrance. So you scroll.
I bring my arms in close, bend down, and actually get down on my hands and knees to crawl into the tea ceremony room.
Tea ceremony is supposed to have in a very small place, small room, because it comes from warrior time. There is no enemy or opposition. So everyone is the same and equal in the tea ceremony room. So you are supposed to take off all your swords and all your weapons before you enter the tea ceremony room.
So it really is about stripping yourself of extras and just
be yourself.
Going to the essence.
Yeah.
Outside the tea ceremony room, it is all about the latest electronic gadget. The Japanese are loading up on more appliances. Here in Tokyo's Akihabara district, people come from all over to buy discount big screen TVs, air conditioners, microwave ovens. It's one reason Japan's carbon emissions are increasing. Since 1990, Japanese household emissions have gone up nearly 40%. And the Japanese are driving more, especially outside the big cities.
My friends have four cars in one household.
Tetsuji Ida is a science reporter for Kyoto News.
One for dad, one for mom, and two for kids.
I mean, it's just like the United States.
Very much like the United States, and so many cars on the street, and even in the very small local city, traffic jam is serious.
And so the government is trying, with this pop song by the girl group Perfume, to persuade regular people to conserve energy. They're talking about giving up a love for plastics in that song. And yes, personal energy use is growing rapidly, says Tetsuji Ida of Kyoto News, but it is not the only or the main culprit.
It's a very, very tiny part of national emission.
So the biggest part is the industrial
emissions. Yeah, I think that we have the biggest part of emission is coming from industries. But there is no incentives created by government.
Incentives like a cap and trade system where companies can buy and sell carbon credits. That's done here in the United States and in European countries. Japanese officials are counting on one incentive we don't have. Masa Ohara is the environmental policy director for the city of Tokyo.
Basically what happens is we publicize their name, the company name, and tell publicly that they're not doing it. Yeah. This works very well for Japanese.
To publicly shame them.
Yes.
It's the same on the national level. I spoke with Kentaro Morita. He's an official with the Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry. Kentaro told me corporations have set their own voluntary targets for reducing carbon emissions.
Once they committed some targets, they will make their best effort to achieve the target without the legal reinforcement.
But do you have to rely on simply the goodwill of industry to think the responsibility,
sorry,
their
very,
own?
Very Japanese way. It means that so Japanese companies are very responsible for the society. So they are very careful about what they are viewed by their citizens. It's Japanese culture.
It's worked to some extent. Corporations have reduced their emissions by 3% from 1990. But still, overall, Japan's greenhouse gas emissions are steadily increasing. They are 14% higher now than they were in 1990. When she's not wearing her kimono and conducting a tea ceremony, Masako Konishi is working on climate change at the World Wildlife Fund. She says it is absurd to believe Japanese companies will voluntarily reduce their emissions enough to meet the Kyoto Protocol limits.
What's happening now is some challenge that we human beings never experienced before. So we need new ideas now.
And she has one. Well, actually, it's an old idea, a really old idea.
Why don't we do the Kyoto Protocol conference in a tea ceremony room? Don't you think it's a great idea?
Yes.
Yeah, so that we, you know, got rid of all the prize and honors and swords and modern weapons, and all the top officials can get in the tea ceremony room and really talk. That might be a very good idea.
That is, if you could get everyone into the room. The biggest polluters, China, India, and the United States, have refused to enter it. They haven't signed the Kyoto Protocol. Until we pull our arms in and agree to some limits, there isn't a lot Japan can do to change the world's climate. For more on Japan and climate change, you can go to our website, npr.org/climateconnections. And Alex, you have been busy working on your own series of climate change stories.
From a very remote place called Palmyra, it's an atoll way out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's difficult to get to, but still a lot of field scientists try to go there because it's sort of a natural wonderland, especially for sea life. They love working there because it's normal in a way that isn't normal anywhere else anymore. And this is how good the science is there. I actually met on Palmyra Boris Worm.
Now, I've known plenty of worms, but never Boris.
Okay, this is a great scientist with an odd name. He studies the impact of commercial fishing on the health of the oceans. He's based at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. That's a long way from Palmyra. But Boris was the lead author of a big study published last year in the journal Science. This is the one that predicts just disaster for the world's oceans. 90% of the species of wild seafood that we currently harvest from the ocean, 90% to be virtually wiped out in the next 40 years unless we do something really drastic.
Gosh, that sounds like a disaster.
It is a disaster, and it gets worse. On Palmyra, Boris told me climate change is making things worse for biodiversity.
You can envision this like a stock portfolio in your retirement fund. You have a lot of companies in there, a lot of different stocks, and that diversity balances out some of the ups and downs that go on. And if there's a perturbation like a war or oil price goes up or down, that diversity buffers out that perturbation. If you only hedge your bets on a few stocks or a few species in an ecosystem, you're less stable in the long term and actually less productive in the long term. There's less of a return. And since we as a species depend on a lot of the returns from ecosystems, such as fish yield, it also affects us and our own well-being. And that's what we showed in that paper.
So that's this marine conservationist, Boris Worm. Met him last summer on Palmyra, the atoll in the Central Pacific, where we have a whole lot of climate change stories coming next week.
Thank you, Alex.